Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, 17th of August. To put our conversation, to frame it this hour, how about this quote from Molière? "It infuriates me to be wrong when I know I'm right." Our guest this hour is the author of Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Catherine Schultz is with us. Catherine is a journalist and an author with a claim to being the world's leading wrongologist. Her freelance writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, The Nation, Foreign Policy, and The Huffington Post. She's the former editor of the online environmental magazine Grist and also a former reporter for the Santiago Times of Santiago, Chile, where she covered environmental, labor, and human rights issues. She was a 2004 recipient of the Pew Fellowship in International Journalism and has reported throughout Central and South America, Japan, and most recently, the Middle East. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Catherine. This is a wide-ranging book. It covers so many aspects of being wrong in terms of relationships. What about being wrong when it comes to huge policy decisions that are made? What about the wrongful interpretation of messages that are received from foreign governments? What about being wrong in medicine? What about being wrong in identifying somebody in a lineup? She has some interesting stories about that. How do we realize that we're wrong and move into a more full understanding of any particular issue? She has a great chapter on illusions, which got us going to the internet this morning to look at some of those illusions, which you'll find just astounding. So we're going to talk about all of that this hour. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Catherine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I normally don't ask people this question because I think it's kind of trite, except in your case, I must. Were you one of those people who did something that you thought something that was terribly wrong and it changed your life? Because I was reading the book and I'm thinking, you are so much in depth on this issue. And to tell you the truth, it's not something, and I should probably now, that I think about very much. This is a huge issue.
Well, I would say that you're not alone in not thinking about wrongness very much, and that's actually part of what got me really interested in the subject matter. For better or for worse, I don't have some huge, dramatic story of life-altering error from my own private experience. In some ways, I wish I did, because it would be a great story. but that's not what got me into this book. And in fact, part of what did get me into it is exactly the point you're making, which is that, you know, wrongness, our attitude toward being wrong, how we feel about it, how we feel about being right, has such a huge influence in so many domains of our lives, whether it's, you know, religion or politics or our own, you know, private domestic relationships. And yet we don't really think about it very often. In fact, quite the opposite. Most of us try to avoid thinking about being wrong as much as possible.
Hmm. And yet, on the other hand, as you point out, those instances when we have been wrong, we remember.
Well, you know, I would say that we have a little bit of a paradoxical relationship to those instances. You're right. Some of them we remember in excruciating detail. We remember them at 3 in the morning when we're trying to sleep and we can't, and instead we kind of cringe and just keep obsessively going over and over some mistake we made. And yet at the same time, we also have what I would call a kind of strange amnesia for our mistakes. Quite often we have a sense of, oh, you know, obviously I'm human, I'm wrong a lot, and yet when you stop someone and ask them to tell you what they've been wrong about, people will very often draw a blank. I think we don't cultivate a mental category called, you know, mistakes I've made, which makes it a little bit difficult to understand why we make them and also to kind of recognize in an ongoing way our own fallibility.
Yeah. This story has stayed with me because I can imagine myself in this field of journalism. I'm sure you can as well, as probably one of the reasons why you included this. The gentleman who was writing an important piece and mistakenly said that somebody on the platform, it had to do with the environment, and yet she had was going to go ahead and have a child, even though there were all these dire things going on, this element of hope in this whole story. And it turned out she wasn't pregnant. Can you tell us that story? It just has stayed with me because I thought I could make that mistake and I would be horrified by that.
Right, exactly. This is something that happened to a colleague of mine, a man named Ross Gelfand, who's a very respected environmental journalist and has been covering environmental issues for, I don't know, decades now. And back in the 70s, he was covering a press conference for a book called The Limits to Growth, which is actually the best-selling environmental book of all time. And the press conference was this big, splashy affair, and there were all these kind of dire predictions about how the sort of international environment was going to hit a tipping point of just kind of a point past which things were just going to get worse and worse in many respects. And one of the co-authors of that book was a woman named Donella Meadows. And as you say, Ross, sitting in the audience, looked at her and noticed or thought he noticed that she was pregnant and saw this as kind of a, you know, as he called it, a sort of beacon of hope in the middle of all of this gloom and doom. And he used it in the kicker to his front page newspaper article about this panel, which was all very well and good, except, right, as we now know, Donella Meadows was not pregnant. And this is such a classic example of a kind of being wrong that just, it makes you want to die, right? I mean, the way that Ross talks about this story is he just says, oh my, you know, I was so mortified. I just, you know, I still, you know, 35 years later when I talk about this, I'm still mortified. And, you know, there are cases where we're making a mistake just that we would rather kind of vanish from the face of the planet than really own up to what just happened.
How true. We may as well tell some of these stories because they're fascinating, and you include Wisconsin in one of these. What about the people who make mistakes, who wrongly identify someone? And then you've got a complicated story because you include the Stephen Avery story in your book.
That's right. There is a chapter in the book that's about a wrongful conviction, a Wisconsin woman who misidentifies her assailant in a really terrible attack that occurred, and as a consequence sent a man to prison for, I believe it was 17 or 18 years, who had in fact not been involved in this crime. And it's interesting you should bring up wrongful convictions. In addition to the book, I've been doing a series of interviews over on Slate, the online magazine, in which I kind of grill various high-profile people about their relationship to being wrong. And the interview that actually just went up this morning is with a man named Peter Neufeld, who's the co-founder of the Innocence Project.
Oh, you're kidding. I didn't even know that. Huh.
And I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with the Innocence Project, an organization that uses DNA testing to exonerate people, innocent people who are in prison or even on death row.
Huh.
And obviously, you know, this is a situation where the stakes of being wrong are just so, so high. It's a question of someone's liberty or even their life. And one of the reasons that I include that particular story in the book is I use it as a framework to talk about our relationship to denial and conversely to acceptance, to the capacity to really own up to one's mistakes. And it's an unusual story because it's one in which the victim of the crime and the person who, misidentified her assailant was able, with what I think remarkable grace, to own up to her mistake immediately and to really wrestle with its causes and its consequences and to do everything in her power to make up for it to the extent that she can. And that's really quite rare when you look at wrongful convictions for reasons that I'm sympathetic to and that I think are totally understandable. Most victims never are able to acknowledge that they made a mistake. And I think sort of more disturbingly, most police, or I shouldn't say most, but many, many police and prosecutors and detectives and so forth also are completely unwilling to acknowledge that there was an error. And even in the face of something as scientific and clear-cut as DNA evidence, they'll say, we know we got the right guy. He's the guilty one. And, I think how that kind of denial is really troubling and something that it's really important that we as a society think hard about.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk more about being wrong in those areas, particularly those occupations that require that you be right or the consequences are absolutely deadly.
Sure. Well, I think that there's a lot of domains like that, but the ones that come to mind first are the really practical ones. I'm thinking of fields like aviation and medicine.
Yes.
Now, you certainly can say that politics is another domain where the stakes of being right are at least as high, if not higher. We obviously do things like start wars on the basis of what we believe to be accurate evidence and so forth. But let's talk for the moment about these kinds of high-stakes technical fields. And they're interesting domains to look at because, as you say, you know, the consequences here are very high. Obviously, none of us ever wants to be the victim of a medical error, or for that matter, the perpetrator of a medical error. And none of us ever wants to see a mistake in aviation. We don't want to see mistakes in, you know, the oil industry, just to take a recent example.
Yes.
And these fields are interesting, and I like to talk about aviation in particular because it's really set the benchmark for a very productive and progressive relationship toward being wrong. The thing that the folks in aviation figured out that's so crucial, I think, is that you can't set out to eliminate mistakes. Human beings are fallible. We're always going to make mistakes. We can't foresee what mistakes we're going to make. If we could, we wouldn't make them. So you can correct for past mistakes, but you can't ever just set as your goal, let's never make mistakes. It's impossible to achieve that goal. And they realized, in addition to that, you can't punish people for making mistakes, because as soon as you make mistakes about blame and fault, all you really do is drive the problem underground, and you make it very hard for people to admit their mistakes. And when people can't admit their mistakes, you can't bring them out into the light of day, understand why they happened, and take steps to make sure they never happen again. So what the smart people in aviation did is they said, let's not focus on getting rid of mistakes. Let's focus on making sure that mistakes don't produce harmful consequences. So what do you get? You get multiple backup systems. So if a mistake is made, something hopefully catches it along the way. You get a system where people are really encouraged to report any kind of problems so that these things do come to light right away. And, you know, not coincidentally, as a result of implementing this very different attitude toward error that accepts it as essentially inevitable and not intrinsically blameworthy, they have really the most spectacular safety record of any high-stakes industry.
Oh, that's interesting. But they still use the phrase frequently, pilot error.
You do occasionally hear the phrase pilot error, but what you don't often see are situations where one single mistake can cause a catastrophic problem on an airplane. In fact, in recent history, for anything to go really wrong in an airplane, typically you have a concatenation of small errors, right? Multiple systems have to fail precisely because there are so many backups in place. And although it's certainly true that human beings can make mistakes and they can make very, very dangerous ones, the industry as a whole focuses on systemic solutions because they understand that you can't just, you know, try to hire the most flawless people and hope for the best, right? Hope that they don't happen to make a mistake. You need to hire, you know, excellent people and give them excellent training, but you also need to put them in a context where, you know, their mistakes aren't going to become catastrophic.
Right. Very interesting. Let's move into this area. You mentioned taking certain kinds of action, sometimes military action, and you don't have accurate evidence. This is a very difficult area, and it's a fascinating one when decisions are made because people adhere to a certain belief system and simply, despite overwhelming evidence, cannot entertain the possibility that they're wrong. And as a result, we are led into wars. We are led into religious clashes, etc. Can you talk more about that? Because it really has gotten us into a whole lot of trouble.
It sure has, and not just us. I mean, I would say the whole collective us of humanity for basically all of the recorded history. You know, the first thing I would say is that it's certainly true that, you know, having a powerful belief system in place prevents us from seeing, you know, counter evidence, seeing the mistakes in our own convictions about the world, or you know, really attending to alternative points of view. And the reason I say that first is that it's very easy to demonize other people for, you know, being these kind of blind ideologues who just cling to a belief system and really can't look at any counter-evidence. And I think it's important to recognize that this is actually something that all of us do. Now, of course, some of us do it more dogmatically and with more extremism than others. But if you look at psychological and cognitive studies of how we as human beings think and how we process information around us, all of us have theories about the world, whether they're, you know, relatively trivial or you know, overarching and organize our whole belief systems. And the very function of those theories is to cause us to treat different kinds of evidence differently. all of us pay a lot more attention to the evidence that confirms our beliefs about the world than the evidence that challenges them. And this is something that we're really all susceptible to. And it's not even intrinsically a bad thing. There's some very sound, logical reasons that we pay more attention to evidence that fits in with our beliefs than evidence that doesn't. That said, this sound, rational, in many ways very effective way of organizing information around us has a very obvious flip side, which is that it can make us really blind to the flaws in our own belief systems. And the more rigid and inflexible of a thinker you are, and the less curious and the less interested in alternative viewpoints, the more you're really running the risk of just kind of blindly plunging forward on the basis of your own convictions without entertaining the possibility that you might be wrong. And when we see that in the political realm or we see that in the religious realm, you know, that's a situation where kind of making decisions on the basis of ideological systems can have very dire and very sweeping consequences. And I think as a result, it's really important that we think about, what kind of political leaders we want and how we want them to think and process information, almost regardless of their, the content of their convictions. I think we should think a little bit about, how they manage their convictions. Do they listen to other people? Do they take into account counter evidence?
Catherine Schultz, our guest. We have a ton of people who would like to speak with you, and we'll go to phone calls momentarily. Her book is Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Carrie is our first caller on I-43. Hi, Carrie. Hi, Carrie. Oh, Carrie, you're not there after you waited.
Yes. Oh, you are.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a bad signal. First of all, I thank you for the topic. This is fascinating. I think it so gets at the core of what makes us human. But it perked my interest very quickly at the beginning of the show because I have a daughter who is 5 who is, to her core, a perfectionist. And we've tried very hard in the family to talk a lot about mistakes, and everybody makes mistakes, and we highlight them and show her all of our mistakes in the hopes that she would lighten up and begin to realize that, she could do the same. And we've largely gotten nowhere with that. We actually have a rule that says everybody has to make one mistake a day. And to this point, she now just points out all of our mistakes, but becomes visibly and physically uncomfortable when we ask her point out one of her mistakes or to apologize for a mistake. It's just something in her. And I'm just curious if you explored this in your research at all with people as young as children.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, and I'm so glad you called in with it. I can say a couple things, and some of it is very good news for you. I'll start by saying we got this hour started with Kathleen asking me how I got interested in this book. And I will say that part of it, I think, came from my own tendencies towards perfectionism and finally, I think, a very belated adult reckoning with the fact that it can be a problematic personality trait. I think in other ways it can be really productive and really useful, but it's difficult to hold yourself to this impossible standard of never making mistakes. One thing I would say about your daughter, and this is one piece of good news, is that some of it might very well be developmental. Obviously, how young children kind of move through developmental stages can be quite idiosyncratic and varied, and all kids do have their own personalities and more pronounced aspects than others. That said, it's very typical for young children to be extremely intolerant of mistakes, either in other people or in themselves, or sometimes both. And it is the kind of trait that can change over time as developmentally kids acquire the capacity to think beyond black and white, to understand about nuance, to get a better grasp on differences of opinion and different perspectives, and also just on the complexity of the world, and to understand that absolute rightness is really not attainable for anyone at any point. So in some ways, it's actually quite typical that a 5-year-old would not have a very good grasp of you know, her own fallibility and a good tolerance for that, because, you know, it is a little bit beyond her developmentally. And so some of it she might well grow out of. The second piece of good news is that it sounds to me that you're handling the situation extremely well. I think that when you get one of these kids who is just so unforgiving of her own mistakes, and it sounds like potentially a little bit critical of other people's as well, I think setting that example where, look, we're adults, we're grown up, and, you know, at that age, kids do see their parents as pretty close to infallible, right, and to sort of running the universe and being in charge. And I think if from the beginning you're sending the message that we get stuff wrong too, that's okay, it's not the end of the world, I think that kind of reinforcement is absolutely right on. I do think it's probably a slow process, and I would encourage you just not to give up and not to see her ongoing resistance as a sign that you're handling it wrong. I think that that kind of change just does tend to come fairly slowly. But again, I think modeling your own mistakes as not, you know, horrible personality defects is really the right road to be on.
It makes you realize how we don't think about this issue, because when she said they talk about a mistake that was made during the day, I can't imagine having that kind of conversation around my kitchen table.
That's right, and I think in some ways, although I imagine it's a tough struggle to be going through as parents, in some ways I wonder if it isn't a little bit of a blessing to the whole family, because there's something, I think, that causes you to think very differently if, you know, at the end of the day you sit around and you think back on, what did I get wrong today? You know, it puts you in touch with your own fallibility,
sure.
But more usefully, I think, even, it puts you in touch with the possibility of, oh, like, what does that mean, and why did it happen, and what could I do differently, and is there something good that can come out of that mistake? And
right.
I suppose that's the other, you know, piece I would add on in terms of parenting this particular child, is there are so many instances where something that seems like a mistake in the moment or is a mistake in the moment really yields a wonderful and welcome outcome down the line. And, you know, that, I think that can also become a part of the family conversation, can be really useful.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Carrie, for the call. Leah in Green Bay. Hi, Leah.
Hi there.
Hi.
This is a great discussion, and one thing that you just said, your guest said, at the end of the day, you say, what did I do wrong? This has been bothering me a lot, because we have a highly valued institution called public relations, and, for example, since the BP spill, I've gotten several emails from various people or individuals or groups where they talk about, they analyze BP, but not in terms of what they did wrong, you know, such as backups that the airline could do, but how they presented themselves after. And it's just like taking the responsibility away from BP for the early mistakes of not listening to the workers and knowing that things were wrong on the rig. It's more like, what should they have done? And now it's good because now they have a new president who can talk folksy. And I think that's institutionalized now, that it doesn't matter what you did, you just have to find a good way to lie about getting out of it.
Hmm.
I think that's correct. There are many situations in which, instead of dealing with the underlying error,
right,
people focus all of their attention on dealing with, you know, what you might call error management, or what we might more aptly call spin. And, you know, needless to say, this does not get at the heart of the problem and doesn't reflect an honest commitment to really understanding and eliminating future mistakes. And I do think that, unfortunately, we're living in a moment where there seems to be a little bit of a kind of wrongness zeitgeist. There's a conversation happening about topics like mistakes and like apology, but unfortunately, I think that quite often they are happening in this kind of surface terms of, you know, well, what language should we be using here, or
yes,
how can we not, you know, how can we avoid sort of negative consequences of these mistakes, as opposed to, you know, okay, well, what actually went wrong here, and what are the, you know, kinds of systems we need to implement to make sure this doesn't happen again?
And wouldn't that be much more effective rather than hiring some person who says, I live around the Gulf, I live on the Gulf, it's my life too, I work for BP, and let me, you just, we're so jaded by all of this. You think, A, does he really? And B, boy, they hired just the right guy to sell us a bill of goods. And what would be much more effective is what you just said. Like the airline industry, we've learned a lesson. We're going to put all these backup plans in place. We will not proceed again like this. It called for a real heartfelt, don't give us public relations, give us a backup plan.
Right, and I think one of the things that's getting in the way here is that we live in an extremely litigious society.
Mm-hmm.
And so especially when you're talking about corporations or you're talking about the political sphere, you know, every time you hear a declaration of responsibility for a mistake or what have you, you know, the reality is those are crafted and vetted by teams of lawyers. This is corporate counsel speaking. And for, you know, various reasons having to do with, you know, keeping the shareholders from suing and so on and so forth, you do get this kind of focus on the PR angle, on managing the perception of the problem as opposed to, a real focus on the actual problem.
Thanks, Leah, for the call. David in La Crosse. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call, and a pretty great topic. I'm kind of a unique example, I think, somewhat. I'm married to a mathematician, and I'm an artist.
Oh, my.
And there's quite an age difference, too. It's 18 years. So we not only have someone who is her job needs to be always correct and make sure that everything is done logically, and that she calls my logic anti-logic. And but I look at the world every day as like, wow, this is cool. Did you see this bug over here? You know, this is neat. And she's like, and it was really hard for her at times when I would change things, because I change them on the moment, you know, just based on the whim, you know. But what I'm seeing right now, it's not just being having to be right or wrong, but the age difference, because I have experience. And the experience that I have as a human on the planet gives me some information that she has not seen or heard of or whatever, you know. And another little problem is what I always saw, too, is that I can make decisions really quickly. And if you make a decision based on all the information you have, you make the best decision you can, and if you find out you're wrong at any time, you change it immediately, and you're the smartest person in the room. And now you're going in the right direction. And I could always go ahead, and I work with physicists and everything, and I made a lot of money selling stuff. And so, to me, that was really neat. I could take that ability to make a decision quickly based on what I had and then admit that I was incorrect and not, you know, I mean, it didn't cast me. I didn't have to wear a red letter or anything like that. I was smart.
Catherine.
So many great topics you're bringing up in this comment. And, you know, I'll touch on one of them first, which is that your marriage, where you've got a mathematician trying to figure out how to get along with an artist and come to joint decisions about the world, or at least respect each other's decisions, highlights the fact that we as a culture have certain overarching attitudes towards wrongness that we share. But one thing that became very evident to me in the course of working on this book is that every single subculture, whether it's a religious subculture or a professional subculture or even to some extent a geographic subculture, has a very different relationship to being wrong. So as you, it sounds like, have lived out in your day-to-day life, mathematicians have one way of thinking about error and mistakes, and artists have another that's completely different. And in those particular cases, I would say that both of those domains actually, in some respects, have very healthy and productive and interesting attitudes toward error, but they are quite different. And I commend you for figuring out a way to make them work together in a hopefully harmonious marriage.
This whole relationship business, you just have to be able to say you're wrong at times, and it's so hard to do. We need to learn how to do that just to get along with each other, I think.
We really do, and I think that, there is a funny little paradox there, which is that on the one hand, there's almost no context in which it's more important to be able to say, you know what, I'm sorry, I'm wrong, I blew it this time, in terms of maintaining some modicum of domestic peace. And yet at the same time, and as I'm sure all of your listeners know, there's few contexts in which it's more maddening to be wrong and to be corrected and decided and admit it, and in which, you know, we often really struggle. And one of the things that I find remarkable and actually kind of touching and charming in terms of just the quirks of our species is that, you know, we really struggle with facing up to our mistakes in our family life, even over incredibly trivial issues. You know, so we spend a lot of time and energy and unfortunately expend a lot of goodwill that could be put to better uses by just, you know, quibbling over these sort of silly issues. And I do think that probably one of the best things you can do in terms of cultivating a happy and you know, thoughtful and considerate relationship is to really, you know, revise your relationship to being wrong and accept the possibility that you are a little more often and extend a little more good faith toward your partner in those moments.
You know what I have to say about that? You're right. And you are. It's also amazing to think of the amount of time you can spend trying to defend your position and those little things. I'm sure you've touched a nerve with a lot of people. You can go on and on and on, not only for a half hour, but you can bring it up the next day and then the next day and the next day, right?
Or, you know, a year on or 10 years on.
Or a year on.
I mentioned earlier this series of interviews about wrongness that I'm doing over at Slate, and the one from last week was with a man named Harville Hendricks, who's a quite well-known marriage counselor. He's a kind of Oprah Winfrey's go-to marriage therapist guy. He appears on her show all the time, and, you know, I asked him about being wrong, and the first words out of his mouth were, "Every couple I see, both people think they're absolutely right."
Thanks, David, for your call. Let's go to Mike from La Crescent, Minnesota. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
Say, this topic really hits home. The worst offender of this, in my experience in the world, are Uber salesmen. The ones that could sell snow cones.
I know. I love watching them.
we have a joke around my shop is because I work for one of them, and it's, if I screw up, I screw up. If he screws up, we screw up. You know, he cannot admit blame.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
And it's been that way with every really, really, really good salesman that I've met in my life, and they're the very same way.
I'll hang up.
This is a wonderful show.
Thanks, Mike.
It's a really interesting observation, and it suggests to me that part of what really good salespeople are selling is their own aptitude, you know, that they're selling their own perfection and as sort of, and then they themselves buy into that package. Like, well, you know, my product is perfect, ergo I am perfect, ergo obviously I have not made a mistake here.
Oh, and some of them are so good. I have things around the house. They got destroyed in the flood a couple weeks ago, unfortunately, but I've fallen victim. You know, how can you resist?
Well, and there's also a really fine line there, I would say, between being wrong and being deceived. You know, it's one thing to get something wrong just because you yourself misinterpret the evidence or just, you know, go through some false line of reasoning that leads you to an erroneous belief. And it's another thing to get something wrong because you invest your faith in someone who deliberately deceives you.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about illusions for a while. You have some wonderful illusions in the book that you can't believe what the truth is because you're sure, you're absolutely positive you're right, and it turns out you're wrong. Why do you include that? What's the role of illusions in wrongness?
Discussion of illusions in the book, not just because they're fun and great and everybody enjoys them, although that is certainly, you know, nice, but because I think they teach us a couple of really interesting lessons about being wrong. One of them is the one that you just gestured toward, which is that, you know, some of these illusions, and if you look at the one I include in the book, and I understand there are links on your website to a similar illusion, you cannot believe your eyes. It just looks absolutely wrong to
you.
And then you go and you look at the proof and you realize, oh my gosh, this is really, I'm totally being fooled here. And so one thing that it shows us is that no matter how convincing our own impression of something might be, there is still a margin of error there. There's still a possibility that we're getting it wrong. And that's, you know, an important lesson for other domains of life that are, you know, more consequential than optical illusions. And I think that another thing that's useful that we learn from illusions is that, you know, we don't misinterpret visual stimuli in an optical illusion because we're stupid. You know, we're not doing something wrong to arrive at this incorrect interpretation of an image. What's in fact happening is an extraordinarily good, sophisticated mental process, a capacity to interpret all kinds of visual stimuli, is doing its usual thing, and it's just being misled. There's just a particular arrangement of objects, designs, light, what have you, that we fall for. And so the point there is that, you know, when we make mistakes, it's not because we've been relying on some inferior part of our brain, some lesser, shoddy, slipshod system. We've been using exactly the same mechanisms that we use to get really outstanding and excellent results, and they just happen to have produced a bad result this time. And I think that lesson is important because we often think that our mistakes are signs of some kind of, you know, intellectual or even moral inferiority, and that's very seldom the case. You know, normally we're being the same smart, able, swift thinkers that we always are, but we just are getting it wrong.
More phone calls in a moment. This hour, our guest is Catherine Schultz. She is the author of Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We're getting some great phone calls this hour. And we are putting some of those, a link to some of those illusions. There's illusions. So if you go to our Facebook page, you can have some fun today with some of those because you will be dumbfounded. Everybody gets it. Well, now that you know it, you'll see it and you'll look for the illusion. You'll look to find out that you were wrong, but you can show them to people and we're all wrong when we see it. They're kind of interesting. So our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Just go there and try some illusions. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a good email that's come in from Karen. I am flabbergasted. I feel like I must be an alien from another planet because I think about this topic a lot and can't imagine other people don't. I feel so strongly about teaching kids it's okay to be wrong and that we learn so much from our mistakes. I was in a relationship with somebody who thought that could never be wrong and had to be right all the time. I think this is the real topic. Why are people so afraid of being wrong? And as a society, this is what we promote. At the same time, I realize the importance of trying to be right about certain things, like the FAA getting the design of an airplane right so that people can feel safe when they fly in it.
I think the listener's right. The heart of this entire topic really is this question of why are we so afraid of being wrong? And, you know, and I think that we were sort of just talking about something that touches on the answer to that question, which is the fact that we tend to associate errors with some being some kind of symbol of inferiority in one way or another. You know, if we get something wrong, we're very quick to assume that something is wrong with us. We take it as an indicator of lesser value or worth. And as long as we do that, of course, it creates a kind of feedback loop where, I made a mistake, I'm a less worthy person, I don't want to own up to that mistake, I don't want to look at that mistake because I feel like I'm going to have to somehow, you know, look at my own fragility and fallibility and, you know, reconsider my own entire identity. Like, a lot of very deep issues about who we think we are and what we think our worth in the world is come up in the face of these mistakes. And it's part of why I really, in the book, really encourage us to think about mistakes in a very different way and cultivate an attitude in which we recognize that, you know, mistakes, first of all, are inevitable. They do happen to everyone. And second of all, are not a sign of some kind of, you know, terrible flaw in our being. Because I think that, you know, once we go down that road of thinking of mistakes in this extremely pessimistic and negative light, it's pretty natural that as a consequence we resort to denying them or trying to downplay them or blaming them on other people instead of just stopping and owning up to them and figuring out what we can learn from them and how best to move on.
Bob in Sparta. Hi. Hey, Bob, are you there?
This is scooter, you got the tricycle.
Sorry, oh, Bob, I think you're talking to somebody else, and we're with you now on the radio. Oh, Bob, please call us back. I'm sorry. We could have just listened in about the tricycle. Let's go next to Marty in Green Bay. Hi, Marty.
Hello.
Hi.
I have an idea, and I would, and which would be to include in our schools from kindergarten through undergraduate the subject of conflict resolution. And I think during this important time, we would progressively develop skills of open-mindedness, self-inquiry, empathy, and tolerance.
I think it's a really excellent idea, and it's one that I wish were widely implemented. Of course, you get pockets of progressive schools that do focus on things like conflict resolution. And you're exactly right that you know, childhood is a crucial window of time for doing so. Kids are relatively conflict-prone and relatively black-and-white thinkers at that age, and yet at the same time also, of course, open to new information and open to, you know, kind of setting down a lifetime worth of ways of thinking about the world and interacting with other people. And, you know, one of the things that I think is important to say is how how very much our current educational system falls short of the ideal that your caller is citing. Not only do we fail to educate kids about conflict resolution in any meaningful way, and I should say that I think conflict resolution is very deeply about attitudes toward being right and being wrong. And if you talk to people who do that work, whether in a school system or as international diplomats, you know, these are people who think obsessively about how to deal with disagreement and how to deal with someone who thinks that you're wrong and how to behave when you think that somebody else is wrong in a way that can be productive and move the conversation forward instead of just resulting in a total stalemate. Not only do we not instill those abilities in our kids, I would say that for the most part we have an education system that actually really beats into kids this idea that errors and mistakes are wrong and are bad and are things to be avoided. When you think about it, by the time you are probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old, when someone hands back to some kid in your class a piece of paper that's covered in red ink and X's and so forth, everybody in the class knows what that means.
Mm-hmm.
They know, you know, oh, that's the dumb kid or that's the troublemaker. They already are busy interpreting mistakes as signs of intellectual and moral failure. When in fact, we know from you know, studies of psychology and child development that kids actually learn best when they make mistakes. They're most motivated to rethink the world. They're most motivated to explore the world and to really kind of try to understand what's going on around them when a belief of theirs collapses.
Thank you, Marty. Daryl from Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen and your guest, and thanks for the show.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a few comments. I'll start off by saying, now, I could be wrong, but I don't think or see that most humans have a belief system. If we did, we would be further along as a world. We don't trust ourselves many times. I think and see that most folks seem to have faith, usually related to religion or money, at least in this country because of Christianity and the dollar, which God rides the back of every greenback dollar. We seem to be a society of and in denial to our own detriment. This makes U.S. wrong because we don't always decide for ourselves.
Catherine.
Well, I would say a couple of things about that. One is that, you know, I do think that most human beings have belief systems, although they might not have consciously thought through deliberately belief systems that are internally coherent. All of us have belief systems because we can't really get through day-to-day life without them. But I certainly think that you're right that, you know, we do not, as a society, always think for ourselves. But this turns out to be a really complicated issue and a little bit of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, we all, I think, understand instinctively the value of independent thought and do sometimes, to some extent, try to encourage that as a, you know, as a virtue in kind of civic-mindedness and creating a better culture and what have you. And at the same time, none of us can fully think for ourselves, right? We live in a very, very complicated society. We're really dependent on other people's ideas and other people's knowledge in order to move through the world. And this is true from the most basic level to the most complex. I mean, if my refrigerator breaks, I'm completely at a loss. I need to call some repairman, and I need to trust that he or she knows what they're doing and are competent to fix it, because I certainly don't have that skill set. And that's a simple example, but when you look around you, you'll realize very quickly that very often when we claim, no matter how ardently, that something is right, what we're really saying is, I think that other person is right. You know, I was listening to NPR today and I heard that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, oh, I was reading, you know, the Washington Post and I read that. You know, we distribute our faith in other people and we draw conclusions accordingly. And I think the main lesson to be learned from that is that it's very important to be really thoughtful and careful about who we place our trust in, because I don't think it's reasonable to try to, you know, kind of come to our own empirical decisions about every single thing in the world. None of us have the time or the ability. But I certainly think it's reasonable to investigate the credentials of the people we Sure. do decide to trust. And also, of course, you know, to the extent that we can, think for ourselves in the sense of paying attention to how we think, paying attention to who we trust, paying attention to how we draw our beliefs about the world, and trying to do that in the most thorough and responsible way that we can.
Thanks, Daryl, for the call. Bob is calling back from Sparta. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm sorry about that earlier one. See, I wanted to help out a little bit in that there's a couple of books that address this really directly, and we've had some really good stories, especially about the gentleman that makes the best decision he can, and then if he finds out later, he changes it immediately and works with scientists. And the books are Why Smart People Do Dumb Things by Dr. Mortimer Feinberg, and the other one is Living in the Now by Eckhart Tolle. And this gentleman I mentioned about earlier, he has control of his ego. He knows the ego does not control him. Hmm. And one of the an example on Feinberg's book, he is a consultant to many large companies, but Sandy Berger comes to mind. In you know, he's got to be a smart guy to be in the White House and everything, but you know, smuggling a secret document out in his pants, I don't know. It's got to be an ego thing.
Right. I mean, there's many, many different kinds of smart, and one of, I would say, the most valuable kinds of intelligence is, in fact, the capacity to recognize the limits of your own intelligence and to recognize what you might not know, what you might not be right about, what might not be a good decision when it's time to consult other people. And in essence, that kind of intelligence amounts to a certain humility, you know, and I think that, ironically, in order to be humble, I actually think in some ways you need to have a very robust ego, not the kind of brazen, sort of chest-thumping, I'm so great kind, but the kind that is able to endure in the face of your own mistakes and to recognize that those mistakes are not an indictment of your overall worth, and that, in fact, the capacity to own up to them can be a real sign of strength and intelligence and moral clarity, and can be, you know, both the honorable thing to do and the right thing to do, and also in some ways can really be rewarded by those around you.
Thanks, Bob. Let's go to Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hey, Scott.
This program's not the worst mistake you've ever made. got a question for you, and I if you discussed this already, I apologize. Did you talk about I caught a little bit of the part where you're talking about airline industry. Talk about the role of checklists. And the reason I mention this, and by the way, a tip of the cap to Chrissy, who looked up the title of this book. It is called Checklist Manifesto. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that one of the things that makes flight as safe as it is that these people in the front of the airplane don't do anything without going down a huge checklist. Did you do this? Did you do that? We do this. Well, Checklist Manifesto is a book by a doctor and a professor someplace in a medical school who is attempting to get these checklists introduced into operating rooms or hospitals in general. In other words, did we do this? Did we do that?
Mm-hmm.
And it is also about the incredible resistance that he's meeting from the physicians, particularly. And I've had some experience in this area, and there's a part of me that thinks that one of the problems with all this is that as you go through some, and I've been around, never as one, but I've been around the training grounds and the workplaces of physicians and attorneys, and there seems to be this procedure by which the system, the law school or the medical school, morphs these people into somebody who is the model of the doctors or lawyers that they want in the AMA or the ABA. And there's something in that process that gets these people to the point where they really don't want to hear this. They really don't want to have, I don't need a checklist. Mm. I'm Dr. So-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to comment?
Yeah, we have about 15 seconds, Catherine.
I'll make it very quick. The book in question is Atul Gawande's The Checklist Manifesto. It is an excellent discussion of these topics. And I think your caller is right. Very often what gets in the way of these very simple, very effective tools to address error is simply the sense that people are above them, that they're too good for them. I'm a surgeon. I'm a lawyer. I don't need this kind of oversight. Get this bureaucratic meddling away from me, when, in fact, we actually all need those kinds of safety measures on us.
Oh, and we never got to dreams or drugs, or we'll have to do another show sometime. Catherine, thank you. It was fascinating.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. Catherine Schultz, the book is Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. S-E-H-U-L-Z is how you spell her name. And we'll look at the checklist manifesto for a show down the road. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for production and on-air work.